Brandon Thurston from Wrestlenomics is up next, and we're going to follow Brandon with John Pollock from Post Wrestling.
Thank you, and good afternoon, everyone.
But we can't ignore the math, okay? We can't ignore the data.
Go on Google Trends, type in your name, then type in mine. You're a straight line. I'm a pyramid.
I like the very direct question on that.
Television ratings, downward spiral. Buy rates plummeting.
The time is now to turn the math around.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another edition of Pollock and Thurston. We are live on this Wednesday, October the 2nd, the five-year anniversary of AEW Dynamite.
Yes.
The beginning of the Wednesday Night War.
I have the Warner Brothers Discovery press room on auto refresh. They have announced that Cardia Brown has signed an exclusive deal with the Food Network. New deal. That has been announced today, in fact, October 2nd, 2024.
Well, we're going to be finding out what else is cooking in the Warner Brothers Discovery press release playbook today. It seems that we are how close are we? Are they about to spike the ball in the end zone? Is that the analogy that would be most appropriate for this?
We might be into the tunnel at this point, I think.
Okay. We have lots it has not officially been made yet. Most are expecting an announcement within the proximity of the day.
Maybe right after we go off the air.
I think it'll be strategic in that we will.
Are we doing a breaking news? If we end the show and then there's an announcement right after, are we going right back to the air?
I will be. That's physically impossible for me.
Will you join us from the car?
I might be texting Brandon to come back on tonight. With me and Wei. Very, very likely that text could be coming. But I guess as we are at this point, I mean, it is. I think everyone has been arrived at the conclusion that this renewal was coming. It's still the particulars, the details that everyone is looking toward. Fightful Select has had some updates in this regard, in the sense of what is to be included in the deal. Fightful Select and Beyond the Bell learning that Dynamite and Collision expected to be simulcast on Max beginning in January. They added that there will be some integration of AEW pay-per-views for Max subscribers, though not sure if those will be included with a subscription or at some discounted rate as well, with early indications that True TV and Rampage were not included in the upcoming announcement.
Which implies that Rampage is moving to True TV.
That's certainly one way of looking at it, certainly would be.
And again, this is from Fightful today, this morning.
Yes, this was just a few hours ago as well, reporting from Andrew Zarian and Sean Ross Sapp. And yeah, it just seems like they're just simply getting ready for a release at any time that could come today. Makes a lot of sense that you would have that as, you know, your late afternoon announcement going into Dynamite tonight and probably some kind of segment with Tony Khan on the show tonight in terms of, you know, celebrating this big announcement. And then the next question will be in the days that follow, if a number gets kind of reported out as well. I don't expect that to be part of the formal announcement from WBD or AEW, unless
I think when we've seen WWE announcements of TV deals, we have, I think, like within the same day where there's a report with somebody reporting what the value of the deal is. Who knows if that will happen here? I'm afraid we're not going to get all of our questions answered, maybe some of them, but I think what the Fightful report is alluding to is that there may be some sort of deal for Rampage, perhaps on True TV is one way to read it. Maybe that won't be included in today's announcement. I know people are wondering, speculating about AEW possibly having another deal, possibly with Fox. I would be surprised if that gets answered today as well.
Because this is going to feel like this is going to be multiple deals. Like it feels like today would be the television announcement, and like, will we get any concrete information about the pay-per-view component of all of this? Perhaps it's all just bundled together in today's announcements. And of course, there's the lingering report from a sports journalist, Swerve Strickland, as well, about the potential of a deal on Fox, which it sounds like he didn't exactly know he was being recorded as he shared this. And I mean, you can take that for what you will.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if that's just like a belief that he has and, or if that's something that he truly has intimate knowledge of. But yeah, we could have all of our arguments resolved today, potentially, if we get a value of what John Rowrand reported a few weeks ago of $170 million AAV. And there's a way to read the more obvious way to read Oran's report from a few weeks ago is that that $170 million AAV would be just for the Warner Brothers Discovery portion, and that they were shopping a separate deal to broadcast. And that's perhaps where Fox would fit in. And maybe we will end all the arguments today and AEW may be officially, maybe financially viable.
I think that should be the headline. AEW may be potentially financially viable after today's news.
And everyone will be satisfied. There will be no skeptics out there. They will all be proven wrong, and they will admit that they were wrong about doubting that AEW would get a deal that would make them profitable.
How many YouTube channels are going to shut down tomorrow? How many are just going to say, you know what? We got it wrong. We're sorry. It's over. We're shutting down.
I mean, it could impact the Google stock. We'll have to watch that.
Oh, I can't wait. So yeah, that's, we're kind of in wait and see mode for all of this. I mean, as you go back to 2019, Brandon, and if you're looking ahead to them being on the precipice of this announcement, I think you could, it's kind of this winding road for AEW that I would say a year into this, I think it greatly exceeded expectations of what this was going to be when they held that first Dynamite show. Certainly they came out of the gate with a lot of buzz. It was at such a down period for WWE in terms of a consumer confidence level. And then you hit the pandemic. They sustained that through being able to get a brand new deal, early on, well, at least, updated deal points in early 2020. And then 2021, they truly hit their popularity peak with the signing of Punk, the signing of Danielson. And then they have gone through, you know, some definite tumult over the last 12 to 18 months. But as we are here, like, would this greatly exceed the optimist view of that AEW consumer in 2019 to where they are 5 years in?
I don't think so. I think unless, you know, it depends on who you ask. By that framing, I was a big AEW optimist and am. If you don't look in the comments of this video though. And I think that it was and is in a good position to be a viable business. And I think there's really only room for two wrestling companies that are really in a position to be viable businesses of anywhere near this scale. And that's WWE and AEW. For everybody else, there's slim pickings for what the media value is that you're able to extract. And there's a lot of other players playing in that, including NWA and MLW. And they're still around. They're still being funded. I don't know if they're profitable, but they haven't gotten real strong TV deals yet that make it obvious. In 2021, their popularity peaked. Their popularity really grew for the first couple of years of their existence. And I think there were probably a lot of people who underestimated the demand that there was for a better wrestling product, which WWE was not providing. And AEW's popularity conversely has, leveled off, to say the least, coinciding with the timing at which that people have become more satisfied with WWE's product as Vince McMahon has been removed from WWE Creative and Paul Levesque has taken it over basically. But it's, yeah, I think this was a business plan that made a lot of sense as Tony Khan looked at the deals that were made by WWE in 2018, knowing something about the sports media rights market and looking at, hey, WWE just more than tripled their rights in 2018. And maybe there is an opportunity in terms of both the ability to make a great deal in this 5-year plan, which we're at the precipice of, combined with the opportunity to obtain all of this talent that was becoming available in the form of Cody and the Young Bucks and Kenny Omega. Eventually CM Punk came along too. And I think it made a lot of sense. And I think for a long time, people believed that nothing could ever hold a candle to Vince McMahon's WWE. And here we have a promotion that is a distant number two, but is about to become, or maybe if the ink is on the paper, there is a finalized deal that will, at least for the term of whatever this deal is, a few years at least, is going to make it in all likelihood viable and self-sustaining.
I think that at the beginning of this, first of all, like, this was a venture that, you know, from day one was going to be one that this was going to be this was not going to be a profit-making venture for the first number of years for AEW. I think they got so ahead of things out of the gate that it raised everyone's expectation of the viability. The timing, you could argue, could not have been more perfect for not just the talent that lined up to be available coming off this great independent boom and the buzz attached to it, a great dissatisfaction with the WWE product. And the question we had was, in this era of television rights fees skyrocketing, WWE getting to enjoy a portion of that, could a non-WWE wrestling product also find meaningful television revenue? Because we have seen so many attempts at different companies trying to get television and significant rights fees. AEW was the one that was able to kind of cross that threshold and be able to do so with a viable network that had a history with professional wrestling. And I think by like 2020, it's a great what if of the momentum that AEW had going when the pandemic really shut them down. And like from the get go, it was Live Gates was going to be their primary revenue driver at the beginning of this with that initial deal that was, you know, a fraction of what they would eventually be getting.
Yeah. I don't know what the expectations were from what was then Warner Media, right? For their ratings, but clearly they were good enough to go from whatever the deal was initially, which, you know, I surmise was something like an ad revenue share that might have just covered the cost of production. And yeah, then in January 2020, they basically reworked their deal and had it to include what eventually became Rampage. And it was worth $44 million AAV. That deal is coming to an end at the very end of this year. That deal has got tacked on to it Collision, which we believe includes even more revenue to at least cover the cost of an additional touring show, which is Collision. The ratings were good enough to renew. And it's because, you know, mainly it was highly ranked and it continues to be highly ranked there. I just had a look at what they were doing for Q3, and they had a median cable primetime original rank of three. And that's a pretty narrow criteria. But if you look at that over the course of time, it's still, despite the ratings, despite the volume of viewership slipping, the rank has been much more stable.
So we're going to be looking at a television lineup that could be greatly expanded in 2025 between WWE and AEW. You will have Dynamite, Collision, in theory, Rampage. There's the potential of whatever comes out of Swerve Strickland's exclusive negotiating Shockwave. And then on the WWE front, we very well could be looking at 3 hours of Raw on Monday night or something approximating it on Netflix. There is the rumor mill out there about SmackDown expanding as well. Like, this is going to be like, in terms of our favorite word, tonnage, we could be hitting unprecedented levels between just these two companies alone in 2025 when all is said and done and all the hours of television are added up on a weekly basis.
Yeah. I feel like, should we have the conversation around tonnage, which is like, yes, there's a risk. There's a risk in giving your fans, your audience, too much content that's too hard for them to follow, that makes it easier for people to fall off. But is that risk, is that negative, does that outweigh the positive, which is more payment, more revenue? And I heartlessly lean on the side of, it's not a big enough risk.
This is a question specifically for you. I know you love discourse and online narratives that form, and the ethos of WrestleNomics has always been in an industry that does not have a whole, like, so much of it is subjective of what is success, and numbers are one thing that you can lean upon. And we have seen over the last 5 years the amount of reliance and interpretation of a lot of the data that you put out there. Do you think it meaningfully changes things? We will know this with Raw most likely on Netflix, but you take away that ability for people, how much that changes perception wise for either company. If we're looking to the future where we may have streaming as our primary consumption for a lot of these products, that if they are not attached to these instant reactions of how well a show performed, like, do you feel that that's going to greatly change things over this next television rights cycle?
What you're saying is, if we don't have TV ratings reports for, say, Raw on Netflix, or if
in theory, like, how much is AEW, like, they feel even more so that they are tied to that immediate reaction of, I think, Dynamite
like
being...
Like, well, how much does online discourse about TV ratings matter to the business, like, in general? Very, very little.
I think that there is overall, I think in particular, I think AEW is very concerned about the discourse and perception that their company has amongst its audience. And that's probably overblown on their part, but it is a major focus that I feel that they do pay attention to.
I think so. We're speculating, but I think so. And yeah, I think most of that should be ignored. Don't follow my timeline is what I would advise, certain people in AEW.
We will, I'm sure we will have some time, over the next few weeks to talk about this AEW TV deal when it is announced. But, we did want to touch upon a couple of topics. We are not going to break down all six episodes of Mr. McMahon. We did a pretty lengthy discussion on the series last week with David Bixenspan that you can go back and listen to. But coming out of, last week, it performed very well by Netflix standards. As I speak about, available data when it comes to, streaming, entertainment. We do have Netflix releasing its top 10 performing series over the last week. Mr. McMahon in the U.S. coming in at number 4 with 28.2 million hours viewed and 4.9 million views. However, this is all tabulated. Behind Monsters, the Lyle and Eric Menendez story. Nobody wants this. Could we have two more diametrically opposed series here in the number 1 and 2 position? And The Perfect Couple, a limited series featuring Liev Schreiber and what's her name? Nicole Kidman.
So I would conclude from this, what, you know, Netflix got some value out of this. This is the fourth most watched show globally, the third most watched show in the U.S. So that probably tells me that Netflix feels like they, I don't know what it cost them to produce this, but I imagine the return on their investment is measured by how much people are actually using the content, watching the content. 4.9 million people globally. They don't share what the number is. And they do that by dividing like watch time by the number of hours. So this is basically, if you do the math, this is not like literally true, but basically there 4.9 million people have basically taken the time to watch the entire series, the entire nearly 6 hour series.
How many of them are podcasters?
Most of them. That is consistent with the number of wrestling podcasts that there are out there.
Every person that logged in was required to do a review of the series based on my timeline.
Yes. Yeah, so a 6-part review of the series as well. Yeah. Commensurate with the number of
episodes. It's a unique embargo. Netflix will give you the screener, but you must, I can't say that either because God knows we didn't get screeners, but nonetheless, I cut you off.
So I don't know how much they spent doing this, but you know, it speaks to the back and forth that we heard about whether or not this thing was going to release, whether they were holding on to it to do additional shooting for it because so many important news stories broke around Vince. But yeah, I mean, this is not like this is in obscurity. A lot of people have watched it. I don't know if people like us really learned that much from watching it, but you know, but the Bill Simmonses of the world, I'm sure were, you know, learned some things by watching it.
Yeah, I think that, again, not to go into a whole discussion about it, but this did feel like a series that crossed over quite a bit. For a lot of people, this is going to be their understanding of Vince McMahon and by extension, WWE. This is going to be a very, like, the most widely distributed, profile on Vince McMahon unless something larger comes about, unless, maybe Vince McMahon produces his own series at some point.
Gets his own story out there. He'd love to do that on LiveWire. What did they say? Now it's our turn, something like that. That was the name of the segment.
That's right. That's right.
He could tell his own story. I don't know if he cares to though. You know, I don't think he was super enthusiastic about doing this piece. And if half the news had that we've learned since June 2022 had broken, I don't think he would have participated. I mean, obviously he canceled all of his interviews that were scheduled to take place after the Wall Street Journal story started breaking. So it strikes me as, you know, maybe he's just not that interested in telling his story, and he's telling, you know, they've got him on camera there saying, I'm not going to tell you the real stories. They're too crazy.
Yeah. I mean, silent in terms of the fallout after the release, which I was surprised he had the statement initially, the fact that he got out ahead of things. But I would be somewhat surprised if we hear any response to the series and puts any more attention on it. But I've been surprised by many of Vince McMahon's moves. By the way, number four in the U.S., number three in Canada. Okay. The Mr. McMahon series.
So. Well, Canadians are bigger wrestling fans, as we all know.
Obviously. We have some other notes coming down. So the feud that is quietly developing, Brandon, it's not AEW versus WWE. It's not Tony Khan versus Paul Levesque. It is SmackDown versus Fox, and it's Friday Night Programming, the graphics battle that has been slowly waging. And here we are, 3 weeks removed from this dissolution of their partnership. And Fox has gone with college football in the previous SmackDown time slot. And as we noted, after that first week of college football, Fox and their graphics team getting out a illustration of how well it performed post SmackDown, doing its highest number since WrestleMania weekend, never naming WWE nor SmackDown. And after two very big performances for Friday's college football games, this past Friday, it was WWE on USA Network topping the Fox game. And thus the real ratings war has begun. The Friday night battle. None of us knew we were entering this brand new era of SmackDown versus Fox that we get for the rest of this year.
Well, Lachlan Murdoch, the Fox CEO, gave us the impression that they couldn't get the value out of SmackDown that they wanted to get, whether or not that means $205 million, which they were paying them on an average annual basis or not, whether there's some loss leader value included in that calculation. In any case, they've decided to go with college football. We're three games in, and two out of the three were more highly viewed than SmackDown almost ever is. This past week, though, not so much. SmackDown did outrank college football on Fox, although there was more college football on Friday in the form of ESPN. And at least, you know, Fox is going out there with their graphics and right on their official PR account, sharing the data. But I wish WWE would, you know, post their own ratings. They could scoop me and probably put me out of business if they would do that. But yeah, WWE wanting to show that they're still a great show and they're still valuable. And maybe, you know, Fox didn't make the right decision here. We're still really strong. But I don't know. We have very little clarity into, like, you know, how much of a return on investment is Fox college football going to get for Fox, and how much is going to cost them. I'm sure it's costing them a lot more than it's costing them for pretty low cost programming in the form of wrestling. It's 52 weeks a year.
Yeah, the final number for SmackDown was 1,568,000 viewers. So that was up 5%. The demo was 0.45, 603,000 viewers. So it was essentially flat from the week prior, but number two on television and, behind the ESPN game, as Brandon had mentioned. Now, Raw on Monday had 1,516,000 viewers and a 0.48 in the demo with 644,000 viewers. This was up against two NFL games, which the combined audience was 20.6 million. So this was actually the most watched in terms of this four weeks of Monday Night Football that we're into so far. And, Raw performed very well for this swan song to the temporary end of the 3 hour era of Raw.
Yes, no more 3 hours of Raw. Along these lines, I put out a big chart just chronicle of the entire history of Raw. Ratings have moved upwards strongly, but if you look back to, say, well, just 2019, let alone earlier years, it is not to the level of 2019, but nonetheless. Like we say about Dynamite, it's continued to rank highly. And because it continues to rank highly, it's still a really valuable show. And it's going to go to Netflix and we'll get paid a little bit more money for it. And all of the downstream effects that have been speculated about that AEW or that WWE might benefit from by being on Netflix, by being on the home screen. We'll see if those effects unfold.
Was there anything that sort of like challenged your going through the numbers for Raw and specific to this 3 hour era that goes back to the summer of 2012? I mean, did you notice any trends of the move to 3 hours when it started to really do a number on the audience? Is like, what was it, something that was immediately felt? Like, when do you feel that and also, like, we did see a shift of the viewership habits when, you know, a year or so into this 3 hour era where suddenly it became, you know, 8 to 10 became the core hours. And then you would see that drop off in hour three, which traditionally was always, you know, you would do your biggest segment at the close of the show. And that was your big, main event segment that everyone would be, that would be the big peak segment.
Yeah. I mean, I don't see, there aren't easy narratives in ratings because there are so many external factors. I mean, if for people watching a video, we have, can people see my mouse? We have the 3 hour, beginning, the beginning of the permanent 3 hour run, you know, marked here, but it's pretty flat until we get into the years where cable cord cutting and cable coverage just starts to decline year over year without any stopping. And that's when viewership really starts to decline and wrestling inhabits this sort of in between space where there is some DVR viewership of it. It's not being completely cannibalized like scripted programming is in the transition to streaming. But it is being diminished. And I would say that the thing that was also happening at the same time is just the content got worse and worse as the years went on there, from 2014 and forward. And I think that contributed as much as anything. You know, it's, you can have a 3 hour show and that's a challenge. And that does make it harder to maintain a rating and you're on later at night. And the 8 o'clock hour and the 9 o'clock hour become the more primary hours for viewership. But if the content is good enough, the people will come. And if you build it, they will come and they will stay and they will watch it. But the content just wasn't good enough through these years. And we've seen at least a stabilization of that decline in more recent years since the return to touring, since Vince became less involved in creative.
Support for this post-wrestling podcast comes from those of you who have picked up our merch over at Chopped Tees. T-shirts, hoodies, sweatshirts, and hats from post-wrestling and our network of shows, including the NWA podcast, Poison Rana, The Long and Winding Royal Road, WrestleNomics, and MCU Later. Free shipping to almost anywhere in the entire world. No minimum spend required. Tag us in a photo of yourself wearing our merch on social media, and I'll even send you a signed postcard while supplies last. That's chop-tees.com/post-wrestling.
It's, do you expect to see, like, we only have 13 weeks essentially to assess this move to 2 hours. I don't think we're going to have enough runway to really see any, like, kind of habits.
Ratings will be up.
I mean, artificially, they should be up by eliminating the lowest hour. I would be curious if this were a bit longer, if the long term, this would impact. Like, I think if you're somebody that has not been watching 3 hours of Raw because of the sheer volume of it for years, you're not just jumping back into things and suddenly dedicating 2 hours every Monday. But over time, I'd be curious if that would slowly change habits. I cannot imagine Brandon Thurston sitting down at 8 p.m. and saying, you know what? I'm going to pick up live viewing of Raw once again. I'm going to live tweet Raw every Monday night.
No, I don't know if there's enough money in the world to make that happen. But you know, it's, you know, what makes people watch this stuff is if they hear that, you know, from their friends or from, you know, if they read from other people that the show is really good and that people will, you know, and that causes people to check it out more. I think the time of the show is a factor, but it's not as big of a factor as, do people like the show or not? Is it a good show? Is it compelling? Is it compelling people emotionally to watch it and to tune in?
As WCW discovered when it, at the end of 99, you know what the problem is? 3 hours of Nitro. That's the answer to all of our woes.
And, it's the NBA competition. It's the economy. I mean, how can you expect to draw money when, you know, you've got these other things that you can point to?
Tuesday night was the debut of NXT on CW. And I know you got this question on Sunday. You wrote a piece on this. What does the move from USA to CW mean for NXT? What are we looking at just in terms of how many more homes CW is available in? And again, we are doing this show before we have got the first set of numbers. I would think everyone would expect a very, very healthy number for this to kick off the CW era and maybe an audience number that is going to be the high watermark, because it's not going to be too many weeks that you have a CM Punk and weeks of promotion. They have promoted these first 2 weeks on CW very effectively.
I would expect, at least in the demo, for this to be the most watched show on CW in the demo year to date. The record that they have to surpass there is 0.15. They were averaging above that on USA Network. I've continued to say, I don't really know whether it be on CW as opposed to the USA Network is on balance a good thing for their ratings when they normalize. This one will be exaggerated and big because it's the premiere and it's been promoted so heavily. But when it normalizes, I don't know if it's going to be the same, a little bit higher, a little bit lower than what they're doing on USA Network. So I just tend to think it's going to be about the same because we've got a fairly low profile broadcast network here that has higher reach. It's got more access in US households because it's on antennas, but it's also a lower profile network than USA, and CW struggles to do similar ratings to the better cable networks. As demonstrated by the biggest demo rating that any telecast has done in primetime is a 0.15 year to date, which was for the 29th annual Critics' Choice Awards. That show also did over 1 million viewers. I'm not so sure they're going to do over 1 million viewers, but they will have a probably, you know, relative to other kinds of programs, probably a disproportionate number of younger people, in their viewer pool, which lends me to think that they'll do a higher demo. And they'll blow away things like Penn and Teller.
Yeah, a couple interesting notes from the debut. First of all, the atmosphere was great, being, you know, with 7,000 or so people at the Allstate Arena. I mean, just totally different, especially for an NXT presentation. Because of being back on broadcast, the elimination of the overrun, we didn't get any picture-in-picture. I was watching the Sportsnet 360 feed, but I did hear like from the US side, like it was,
and there was never any picture in picture on Fox. That might be something about broadcast there.
Yeah. And they had a title sponsor as well. I believe like Progressive was a sponsor that they did mention at the beginning, which was previously the sponsor of SmackDown. So those were some of the notes coming out of the debut on Tuesday. So we will get the ratings later today. Potentially a TV announcement, NXT debut on CW, all of this coming out at once today. It's going to be a...
Do you have a prediction for the rating?
For NXT, last week, let's look. They did a 620 and a 0.19. I'm going to say they're going to top both those numbers on CW by a strong margin. I'm going to go 0.25 for the demo, and I'll say they do 900,000. Viewers. That'll be my prediction.
I also predicted 900,000 viewers this past Sunday. So,
okay, we will see. Do you feel that this will be a mark that they hit again within the next year?
No.
Okay. No. I think there's a very strong chance of that.
I mean, Dynamite's biggest rating ever was its first one. SmackDown on Fox, its biggest rating ever was the first one. Rampage, its biggest rating ever was the second one. But if not for Punk debuting on that episode, it would have been the first one. What else? Collision's biggest rating ever was the first one, and it did have Punk on it. But I think even if not for that, it still would have probably been the biggest one.
NXT had those, granted, their first two episodes on USA were unopposed. AEW didn't start till week three, but like those were monster numbers.
And they did 1 hour or two. I think the second hours were on W Network.
That's right.
Yeah, but similar effect. And that's not like an indictment. You know, people want to twist it into be like, all these people checked it out and they decided they hated the show, obviously, because it went down. But no, it's, you know, you heavily promote a show and there's a lot of delayed viewing or a lot of people who are only watching once in a while, but everybody joins in and makes sure that they check out that heavily hyped first episode. And that's been true for a variety of wrestling programs.
And typically the pattern is like you put all that promotion into that first week on the program and then you kind of settle in after that. I like they have put a ton of resources into week two as well, kind of by necessity. They are on the road. There's more than just a number to draw, but you know, they do have a loaded up show next week with Randy Orton, Bianca Belair, and Jade Cargill are going to be wrestling on that show. But that was the show that got moved from the Enterprise Center to Chesterfield, Missouri, which is just being identified as St. Louis on television. Yeah, okay, it's Chesterfield.
You can't go to places like Chesterfield.
Some similarities between Paul Levesque and his father-in-law when
some of those things leave a strong impression.
Yes. Anyway, well, Chesterfield, they're coming at you next week. All right, well, we are going to be shifting focus now. A number of weeks ago, we spoke about the lawsuit that was filed on behalf of Kevin Foote, aka Kevin Kelly, and Brandon and Brent, the Tate twins, filing a class action complaint against All Elite Wrestling, Tony Khan, and Ian Riccaboni in the Court of Common Pleas of Philadelphia County. Representing the plaintiffs is lawyer Steve New, who is going to be joining us now on the program to break down, I should pluralize this, cases, because there is a lot in this. But first of all, Steve, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much. Thanks for having me on, guys.
So why don't you just explain, first of all, there's a number of different elements to this case. It seems at the core of the matter is finding out if AEW talents have been misclassified as independent contractors. And is that sort of step one in this process? Because it seems like it's a multi-step process here, going through the defamation aspect to the wrongful termination. But there's also at the heart of the matter, this overarching issue about classification.
Yeah. So let's take a couple steps back.
Sure.
From that, if we can, John, because at its base, this action is a breach of contract action, because all three of these talent were under a contract with All Elite Wrestling. Okay. And so that contract forms the basis of all of this, because these talent were not let go upon the fulfillment of the contract by All Elite Wrestling. So you kind of have to begin with the contract itself.
So what you're saying is that their contracts were terminated as opposed to being allowed to expire.
Yes, their contracts were terminated in Kevin Kelly's case about 27 months before the contract called for its expiration. And in the Tates, I think they were about maybe 6 months into a 2-year deal. So you kind of have to begin there as a breach of contract matter. Then overlaid on that are the defamation aspects of this. I don't believe that an employer has the ability to defame its employees. So in this case, the most clear example of that is Tony Khan accusing the Tates of being no-shows. When a billionaire owner of sports franchises speaks, people listen. And so when Tony Khan called the Tates no-shows, knowing that that was false, then that's where you have the defamatory statements there. With the Riccoboni...
Before we go to Ian Riccoboni, if you could just explain further on the Tates. Like, we understand there was a show in Ottawa that they did miss, but would it be their contention that it was out of their control that they missed the show? Because there was a show missed, correct?
Yes, there was a show missed, and for whoever manages AEW's travel, Knoxville and Nashville, Tennessee are two totally different cities.
Mm-hmm. They had previously been flowing out of Knoxville, and for this particular trip, they were told that they would have to fly out of Nashville and their side.
No, they were scheduled to come out of Nashville, their home of record, and where they informed AEW's travel people they fly out of is Knoxville. So believing they were scheduled and would get tickets and arrangements to fly out of Knoxville, they didn't go to Nashville to fly out. And so hence the miscommunication, hence the missed show.
And then in terms of the onto the other accusation, and that involves strictly with Kevin Kelly and Ian Riccoboni. And can you, before you get into the specifics about that, like, what is the strategy of lumping all of this together into this suit? Because there are, you know, parties that do not have issues with one another necessarily there, but it is grouped together here with the Tates and Kevin Kelly and these different infractions.
The talent agreement is the same. So that's the common thread through all of this. And this is why I backed you up a couple of steps. The common thread through all of this is the talent agreement, the independent contractor agreement. So even though Kevin Kelly is an announcer, and even though the Tates are in-ring talent, the string that binds all of this together is the quote unquote independent contractor talent agreement.
And I understand to continue this case, probably one of the first hurdles there'll be is there'll be a motion to compel arbitration, because there are evidently arbitration clauses in these contracts. Something we interacted about a little bit through email was about the notion of filing an unfair labor practice that, if I'm not wrong, might help you overcome a motion to compel arbitration. And could you speak to, is that something that you are considering doing with the NLRB?
Those are two totally separate things. I mean, we have to prove to the judge that in the event that AEW's lawyers raise arbitration, and I have every reason to think that they will, just like WWE's lawyers raised arbitration in the Janelle Grant lawsuit, we have to deal with that in the forum. Going to the NLRB on a misclassification claim isn't going to help us overcome whether or not these cases should be arbitrated in Northern Florida instead of being litigated in Eastern Pennsylvania.
In doing some research about this case, I understand you represented Kelly Klein in a lawsuit against Sinclair Broadcasting and Ring of Honor, and that also resulted in a motion to compel arbitration, and the judge did rule that it should go to arbitration. And there, I understand there's something called procedural unconscionability and substantive unconscionability, and of course these are different contracts with different wrestling companies. But what can you tell us to argue that this will be a different result? We're not able to see the text of the contracts. Those have been filed under seal. But what is different about this case that will result in a different outcome when it comes to arbitration?
I believe just the greater level of control, in a way. And, here's the problem with the Kelly Klein case, because of the sheer cost of having to challenge that. We could have appealed in Maryland, or we could have challenged arbitrability before AAA or JAMS or whoever it was. But it's very costly to do that. So the facts are pretty much the same regardless of which wrestling company that you're talking about. When you look at that 17-factor IRS test for control, I think that wrestling companies hit about 15 out of 17 factors of just how much they control this talent. So the question is going to be, do you end up before a judge or an arbitrator eventually who looks and says, hey, this shouldn't be arbitrated at all. That this, arbitration provision is unconscionable, like you said. So it's just going to be a factual determination for this judge to make here, looking at all aspects of the AEW contract, perhaps giving us some limited discovery on the issue of whether this should be arbitrated.
I thought it was very interesting in reading the judge's ruling in that case, that the judge seemed to be to find it to persuasive, or I think the wording was, you made a substantive argument here that there's misclassification happening, but nonetheless, that still did not satisfy the substantive unconscionability condition, which is, as I understand it, it's making the argument that this was such a one-sided agreement that it cannot be upheld.
Right. And the take it or leave it nature of it, with agents saying, look, you're in the case of the Tates, you're not going to get a deal. You're never going to be more than, we're just going to call you if we're near your area type of a thing, if you don't sign this really, really bad, unconscionable contract.
Now, shifting over to the involvement specifically between Kevin Foote, a.k.a. Kevin Kelly, with Ian Riccoboni. This one seems to be the one that I have seen in the public that has received the most, I think, pushback towards this. I think there's a lot of sympathy towards getting to the bottom of wrestlers and how they're being classified. I think in this case with Ian Riccoboni, I think a lot of people look at, number one, the high bar just to prove defamation and getting into the weeds of, his statement that he did make on that Discord, if it feels like he is kind of being singled out here for actions that went beyond him. I know you're going to probably argue that point, but it seems to be that has been the one that there has been a negativity towards this.
Rick Abani is the one that said that my client was a member of QAnon.
He stated, let's get the exact wording here, also had no idea he was going to promote QAnon movies, or else I might have made a different suggestion. I suppose that his name was always in the mix, but that QAnon stuff breaks my heart a little bit. That was the comment from the Discord channel.
Yeah. And that's defamatory. My client is not a QAnon member. He's not some member of some conspiracy theory group. And so,
Are you arguing that it's this, that his statement, which again is also had no idea he was going to promote QAnon movies, referring to the Sound of Freedom, is that the same thing as saying that this person is a member of QAnon? Because you do say in the complaint itself, the movie has been associated with QAnon in social media.
Yeah. I think if you read that quote, and again, this is what was on Discord, right? This is what received the publication. So my client thought, and I think that you can look, and when our reputation expert goes through all of the stuff that was said on the internet about this and what the pub, see, this is a, it's not about what Ian Riccoboni simply intended. It's about how it was received by those who read it. I'm representing a young man right now who was a collegiate basketball player at the University of Alabama last year. And he was called, he said, the New York Times said that he was involved in a murder. Involved in the killing of another human being. He wasn't even on the scene. And so, you know.
But isn't proving defamation part of it on your part? You do have to prove intent here that he was trying to maliciously harm Kevin Kelly.
No, that's not intent. Well,
clarify for us.
Because Kevin Kelly is a public figure, you may have to show that it was done with malice, with a reckless disregard for the truth. Not necessarily the same thing as intent. It's that harm is likely to ensue. But it's the publication of a statement knowing that it's false with a disregard that it's false. Those are the four elements of defamation.
So my question would be as well, like when it comes to the Sound of Freedom, like we will all acknowledge that there is an association to QAnon, but how is one to prove what is or is not a quote unquote QAnon movie? I mean, this gets into opinion, does it not?
I don't think so. Not when someone goes to the internet, to Discord, and states it as fact.
Yeah. I mean, it's his opinion that it's a QAnon movie.
No, the fact stated by Rick Abani is that my client is promoting QAnon conspiracy. That's the fact. It's not, if Rick Abani had said, I believe Sound of Freedom is a QAnon inspired, QAnon associated movie, that's an opinion. Where he associates someone with it as a matter of fact, that becomes different.
But Kevin Kelly did promote this movie.
He said he liked the movie.
He encouraged people to get tickets for it. There were free tickets as a promotion for this.
The Facebook post is, please help yourself to free tickets and share the message. And that post contained a link to Sound of Freedom tickets.
Okay.
I think this one's a real high bar to reach, Steve. You're the legal expert, not me. But I think this is one where I feel that so much more happened in the fallout out of this, that Kevin Kelly has spoken publicly about the fact that he was on the bench. He quote unquote went off on Twitter during Revolution weekend. And it was after that weekend of speaking about this publicly that he was let go by the company. Like this
what
feels more to me like
what
this
happened
is like
in the months leading up to that, John. Why did Ian Riccoboni want to say that about Kevin Kelly? See, there's a whole lot right now that I can't tell you that if we get to discovery is going to come out, okay? Because there's a whole span of time there, months, between what Riccoboni said and when he said it and then when Kevin Kelly was benched. So that there's a whole lot that you don't know that I can't tell you right now, that that's what the discovery process for. See, here in the United States, we have this little thing called the United States Constitution. And in 1789, we passed this thing called the Bill of Rights. And Amendment number 7 to that Bill of Rights is the right to trial by jury in civil cases. Americans have a constitutional right to have a jury of their peers decide these things. And when there's arbitration, they lose that constitutional right. Everybody likes to talk about freedom of the press under the First Amendment, Second Amendment right to guns, Fifth Amendment rights against self-incrimination. But a lot of people just gloss over the Seventh Amendment right to trial by jury. This case should be taking place in a courtroom with the discovery process, because it's the discovery process that bears all of this out. You put a witness under oath for 7 hours and you ask him or her questions under oath. You get documents exchanged in a free flow. That's where the truth comes out. So there's a whole lot that I know right now that I'm not going to reveal on a podcast or a show about the months leading up to Kevin.
You're welcome to, though, if you would like to.
No, thank you.
Well, I feel like, just to go through the timeline here, like Kevin Kelly to say benched, like he was moved to become the third voice. They added Tony Schiavone on Collision, and then he was not getting assignments on pay-per-view, correct? That was in the months that followed this.
Right. He was hired to be an announcer on Collision.
Right. But it was AEW that made this call to make. I'm just looking at like what the obvious defense is going to be of AEW is they are going to argue this was their call based on performance. This had nothing to do with Ian Riccaboni making this line in a Discord.
Okay. And the New York Times said we had a constitutional right to call my client, who was a 18-year-old kid from Pittsburgh, a murderer or involved in a murder.
Okay. So well, we're not talking about murder.
I expect defenses. I don't think AEW is going to file a response and say, oh, you got us. I expect there to be some argument by AEW that it had a legitimate reason for doing what it did. Again, that's the reason for the discovery process.
What is the next step in this process that goes through, and what is kind of in the immediate periphery for you when it comes to the next steps of this case is for people to be watching for?
AEW's lawyers from Philadelphia and Jacksonville have until October 7 to file what's called responsive pleadings. They can either answer the lawsuit and file an answer, and the case moves forward in the Court of Common Pleas in Philadelphia, or they can, as WWE and McMahon and John Laurinaitis did in the Janelle Grant case, move to dismiss and asking the judge to compel arbitration. So that will happen on October 7th. And the court will probably give us a hearing date thereafter.
And what would be like an estimate of like that time? Is that just out of your control in terms of like a rough ballpark period that they would set a trial date for? Would we be looking at early next year?
It's not a trial date. It would be a hearing date.
Hearing date. My mistake.
If there's a motion to dismiss on the basis of compelling arbitration, that motion is filed. I have to have a certain period of time to respond. And then the court might say, we're going to set a hearing 60 days from October 7, and knew you have 30 days to respond.
While we have you as here, this is always a topic that comes up, and I'd be curious just to pick your brain about, because I'm sure this is something that you have seen yourself. And that is, and this is not exclusive to any one wrestling company, but when there are injuries to certain performers, and time gets tacked on at the end of contracts. And I've always been curious if anyone were ever to challenge these. And if you have a thought on that practice that is generally accepted now within pro wrestling, that you are injured for 6 months, even if you're injured in the ring, that that time is made up at the back end of a contract. Do you see that as an aspect that could be challenged? Because I would always be interested to hear that from a legal expert of whether these companies could really enforce this if they were really pressed against the wall to defend this practice.
You couldn't do that if these people were employees. They'd be drawing workers' comp.
Mm-hmm.
You couldn't do that if these were actual employees. That would be illegal. That would be improper.
And do you have an opinion across AEW wrestlers generally, where there are some wrestlers who are taking more or less outside bookings? Do you have the opinion that basically all of those wrestlers are misclassified, right? And even there are some people with dual classification, they are employees as like an advisor role and they are talent. Like, are they even misclassified in those cases as independent contractors where they should be employees, even in that dual class situation?
Yeah, I think so, because, and I've represented someone with that dual classification. They have separate contracts for that. It's not under the same contract. There will be an employment contract for their whatever duties, and then for whatever in-ring or what have you is under the independent contractor agreement.
Because the control factors are just so numerous that it supports an argument.
Right.
Has there been, I'm not asking you to name names, but has there been outreach from other talents that just want to learn more about this? Because as you outline in the case, like, this can cover all AEW talent going back to 2019. Any responses you've heard in the past month?
Yeah, tremendous interest.
And do you,
I mean, imagine if someone's been there for a number of years and all of a sudden then they might have years worth of benefits owed to them. Social Security, Medicare, withholdings, that kind of thing, that could be substantial potentially.
And that could be a significant process to go through, I imagine, on yes, the legal front. That, I mean, this could be like years. Is that hyperbole?
No. Even the simplest of cases these days seem to go on for years. And it's certainly not a simple case. Now, you know, talking about the misclassification, I'm under no illusions that this is an easy case at all, just because I happen to think that wrestlers are misclassified employees doesn't mean that a judge or an arbitrator or whomever may agree with me. So I understand I'm under no illusions here, but I do believe that we're on the side of the angels. I do believe that wrestlers have been treated horribly for decades now, and I do believe that they have been controlled. I believe that they've been taken advantage of. I believe that their bodies are the ones that are left crippled, you know, and having GoFundMes for burial funds and medical bills, while, you know, some billionaire, Florida seems to be the place of choice for lots of billionaires or wannabe billionaires. So some wannabe billionaires never taking a bump, or some actual billionaires in Florida on a yacht, or, you know, in the Mediterranean on a yacht, while some poor guy from Mississippi who's had his legs amputated is trying to do a GoFundMe for a burial fund. Doesn't seem fair to me, but what do I know?
My last question for you is, you know, following the industry as long as you have, Steve, why it's never been able to get to that point where you have been able to see wrestlers be able to band together and move forward with this? Is that just the way it's baked into the industry? That, I mean, I'm certain that you've heard from people privately, it's a big leap for them to go public with those same opinions, I'm sure.
Yeah. Ask Jesse the Body Ventura what happened.
Yeah.
It seems that the desire to get an advantage in this, you know, it's a worked business. The matches are worked, but it's still a competitive business. I think the desire to have that little bit of an advantage is, you know, outweighs, unfortunately, the desire to have a greater good to protect workers.
And all of these guys and gals are just looking for a push. You know, hey, if I just get my push, I'm going to be the next Rock. I'm going to be the next John Cena. I'm going to have a Hollywood career. I'm going to, by the way, all the wrestlers who have those nice, cushy SAG-AFTRA contracts, read what Terry Funk said about when he got into Hollywood acting and became a member of SAG-AFTRA, how that changed Terry Funk's life. Think it doesn't benefit wrestlers when they cross over into Hollywood and they get to belong to SAG-AFTRA, then that's kind of a life-changing moment for that wrestler at that point. But to Brandon's point, everybody's always looking for that little edge. Everybody, and the wrestlers are so beholden to who gets a push, who doesn't get a push, right, who gets used on cards, who doesn't get used on cards, whether you're under a contract or not. And so because of that aspect of the business, you know, it really pushes against somebody wanting to take a stand and say, hey, you know, this is not right. It's not right as it relates to me. And wrestlers, I don't think many of them think about future wrestlers who are the ones coming behind them.
Well, Steve, we want to thank you for jumping on with us, talking about this case, and I'm sure we're going to be following it with a lot of interest because okay, there's a lot of significant topics attached to this one. So thanks for the time today.
All right. Thanks for letting me come on and talk about two of the things that I love most in the world, and that is the law and pro wrestling. So thanks for having me on, guys.
All right. Thanks. Thank you, Steve. That was Steve New joining us to talk about the ongoing case that was filed last month on behalf of Kevin Kelly and the Tates against AEW, Tony Khan, and Ian Riccaboni. So, as we can see on like a even broader scope, what we've been following with the UFC antitrust case. I mean, this is a process that, as Steve outlined, it's a pretty arduous one and very tough to find wrestlers that are going to get at the forefront of something like this. But I think the misclassification element to this is the strongest point, I think, attached to this particular case that galvanizes a lot of the audience as well, that probably has similar feelings when it comes to talents and their protections or lack thereof.
Yeah. And I was, you know, thinking earlier today, it's sort of a perfect quagmire in that there's like just enough incentive to on the part of workers to not cause some sort of change in the treatment of workers, whether it's unionization, making an association, or getting out of misclassification, it's persisted for so long, at least in the case of UFC fighters who are not even doing that. They're at least involved in an antitrust lawsuit with many of the fighters. There is at least in the case of UFC fighters, you presumably go into the octagon and you fight and you have a fair opportunity to win your fight or not. In the case of wrestling, it's one booker man's decision whether or not you get to have a match be on TV and whether or not you get to go over. So there's, I think, even more pressure in the case of wrestling. And it's unfortunate. I just don't know when there's going to be enough incentive to change. There were moments, you know, in the recent past in terms of COVID, in terms of the controversy around WWE disallowing people from using Twitch and YouTube and Cameo and things like that. But still, we're at the same place we've been for decades.
Support for this Post Wrestling Podcast comes from those of you who have picked up our merch over at Chopped Tees. T-shirts, hoodies, sweatshirts, and hats from Post Wrestling and our network of shows, including the NWA Podcast, Poison Rana, The Long and Winding Royal Road, WrestleNomics, and MCU Later. Free shipping to almost anywhere in the entire world. No minimum spend required. Tag us in a photo of yourself wearing our merch on social media, and I'll even send you a signed postcard while supplies last. That's chop-tees.com/postwrestling.
There was a clip I did want to play. This was back a number of months ago. This was before the lawsuit was filed. This was when Kevin Kelly was on Eric Bischoff's show and describing his exit from AEW earlier this year.
This was really troubling me, and it was affecting my relationships at home. It was obviously affecting my work, and I was getting worse and worse. And beginning of March, it was the weekend of Sting's last show. I wanted to be there. I wasn't booked, and I went off. and I went off on social media and I called the poor HR lady and left her a message. And it was, I'm sure it was stiff. I don't remember what I said, Eric, but I'm sure it was stiff.
So that was Kevin Kelly. It's a longer clip, obviously, that you can listen to on his appearance earlier this year with Eric Bischoff. I think that is the aspect. I think that for many viewing this, I see Ian Riccaboni as a figure that I don't see a lot of people viewing as the person that necessarily caused all of this great harm. But if you're Kevin Kelly and you're swarmed with all of your, like, these QAnon comments that he has mentioned in the past, I think that's, if he goes back to that specific line in the Discord channel, that's what he's associating the blame to. And I just think that it's like we read that line as it is. And I just I don't find that the idea of linking Sound of Freedom to QAnon was not something that came out of the Discord channel through Ian Riccaboni. Like, this was something that was heavily prevalent and one that's even outlined in the case that there is an association of. And
right.
I made sure to get Riccaboni's the exact line out there because he does not state Kevin Kelly is a member of QAnon. That
he
is
says,
not stated.
Also had no idea he was going to promote QAnon movies, or else I might have made a different suggestion. I suppose that his name was always in the mix, but QAnon stuff kind of breaks my heart a bit, which we just discussed with Steve, that that's not explicitly saying that he's a member of QAnon. He's promoted a movie, which Riccaboni is referring to as a QAnon movie. I'm not sure that's the same thing as saying someone is a member of a group called QAnon. I can say, you know, I think hay is great. I really, really promote hay, and you should eat some hay. That's not quite the same thing as saying I'm a horse, though. So does that make sense?
Perfect. Analogy? Yeah. Okay. Perfect one. Yeah. I think that is where I think you're going to have a lot of disagreement towards this suit. Not so much of whether you feel Ian Riccaboni was right or wrong, but when you're named to a suit, like, it's costly to defend yourself in a situation like this. And I think that there is going to be that sympathy for an Ian Riccaboni. And if this really passes the smell test, but that's
at this point, according to the docket, all of the defendants are represented by the same lawyers. So it could be the case that AEW is paying for the legal bills here.
Possible.
Which involve Riccaboni and Tony Khan and AEW itself. Those are the three defendants. It's the company, Tony Khan, and Ian Riccaboni.
All right. We'll be following this case because there's some very, you know, significant aspects to this, and one that I don't see ending anytime soon either if they are committed to seeing this through. Like, the misclassification, like, that is that's a very significant argument that they are trying to push through. And you can imagine they will receive great resistance from AEW regarding that.
And as we just discussed, you know, hurdle number one is going to be whether or not this is sent to arbitration. And if it's sent to arbitration, that's the last we'll hear of it publicly, because arbitration by its nature is private. And it was difficult. The Kelly Klein case was sent to arbitration, different contract, different situation. Yes. That looks like a big challenge, and the hurdles to showing, to convincing a judge that this agreement is unconscionable, that bar is pretty high.
All right. We're going to wrap things up, but thanks to everyone for joining us today on the show. We will be back next week in our regular time, and stay tuned, because tonight Wei Ting and I will be live after the 5th anniversary of Dynamite, and maybe we'll be joined by a guest to be determined based on the news cycle and his availability.
We have a couple of super chats that we can address too. From MJ saying, I saw Brandon took issue today with something. Somebody using his work but not linking to it on X Post, regularly uses quotes from others to make headlines that link to its website, not original work via X. And he follows up, any comments on this practice of aggregating for clicks to post and using summaries of your website to render the work of others obsolete? How is that different from what Brandon called out? I think you do link to the original work, if not all the time, most of the time. But that's, yeah, it's the link that is... That is especially on Twitter, I'll call it Twitter still, that they don't link to the original work because for Twitter's algorithmic reasons, you know, they don't want links in their posts because that sends people off the platform. So the engagement tweeters have learned to not include the link in the original post. And sometimes they're just giving text attribution. Sometimes they're not giving attribution at all. And I think that's discouraging for the original reporter. And I think it also encourages, but the whole psychology around the paid blue check, it encourages engagement, not truthful information sharing.
Yes. On that note, did we have any others? There was one here from, this is kind of answered in, the interview because we did bring it up, but, Plethora did ask about, AEW adding injury time. Yeah. It's one that until it's challenged, like you really don't know what, if that ever got to a judge, like just what they would, think, and maybe they would back the companies, maybe not, but it's become common practice now. And again, it's not limited to AEW. It's not limited to WWE either. Like we've seen multiple instances of it as well. And yes.
I have no comment on this, whether or not I'm sponsored by Big A.
No. All right.
For focus on the future.
So again, Rewind to Dynamite tonight. And we also have completed our series on Mr. McMahon. If you heard our chat last week with David Bixenspan, Way and I did individual reviews of each episode up at postwrestlingcafe.com, going through each one. So the final review of episode 6 dropped earlier this morning. And this Sunday, it's the first Sunday of the month. So Brandon will be live 11 a.m. Eastern time with WrestleNomics Radio, probably discussing the AEW television deal would be my,
I have a feeling it will be an eventful episode. Open to the public.
That's right. You've got, you're coming out of Bad Blood, which is, going to be a very big show for WWE in Atlanta this coming, Saturday night and, into the new television rights era.
Yes. Yes. We'll, if there's an announcement, I know there's more reports we're being told, as this show has gone on. Hopefully we'll have an even clearer idea, by Sunday.
All right. Thanks everyone for joining us. We're here every Wednesday, 1 p.m. Eastern time. For more, check out postwrestling.com and WrestleNomics.com. That is it for Brandon Thurston. I'm John Pollock. Thanks for tuning in.